Hello and welcome to Get a Better Handle on Life. I'm Barry Winbolt and this is my podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from a guest who exemplifies positivity, and that doesn't even begin to describe it. Terry Tucker's story transcends the ordinary definition of inspiration, his resilience and positivity, even in the face of adversity, are truly remarkable. From battling cancer and undergoing the amputation of his left leg, Terry emerges as a beacon of hope and motivation. We'll be hearing about his journey, discovering how he learned to embrace life fully. Oh, and you'll even hear how he got outvoted in terms of his treatment, by his family no less. This compelling conversation is filled with invaluable insights, experience, and unwavering determination. So today I have the great pleasure in speaking to motivational speaker. That's his moniker, but actually that's a very modest statement from what I've seen, Terry Tucker. Hello, Terry.
Barry, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Now, there is so much about you on the web because you do a lot of, and you give a lot of interviews for very good reason. So I kind of thought we'd skip too much of the history, because what I'm really interested in is you and what makes you tick and how you do what you do and how you transmit what you do. Could you give me kind of a thumbnail sketch, a sort of a bio of what you've done? Because one thing I noticed about you when I first came across you, you've had more jobs than me. And that is saying something. Because, you know, I grew up in the 60s and you just went out and got a job. And it was that easy. But there was never any notion of career. But I think in your case, it was. You started out with basketball, I believe.
I did. I was 9 years old when I started playing basketball and was lucky enough to receive a scholarship to play in college. So I played all the way up until I was 21 when I graduated. And when I did graduate, I moved home to find a job. I'm really going to date myself now, but this was long before the internet was available to help people find employment. Fortunately, I found that first job in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain, in their marketing department. That was the good news. The bad news was that I lived with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. Professionally, as I said, started out at Wendy's, and then I went to work for the hospital that actually cared for my father and my grandmother. And then I made a major pivot in my life and really kind of got into my purpose. And I felt my purpose was to follow in my grandfather's footsteps, which was to be in law enforcement. And one of the jobs I had as a police officer was I was a SWAT hostage negotiator. After that, I started a school security consulting business, coached girls high school basketball. But for the last 12 years now, I've been battling a rare form of cancer, a rare form of melanoma, that has really caused me to sort of pivot and do different things. You know, when you can't do what you're good at, you do what's important. And that's really what I feel I've been doing for at least the last 4 to 5 years of podcasting and writing and things like that.
And you sound like somebody who has a purpose. What is it right now? I don't mean in this podcast. I mean in your life.
Yeah. And, you know, we tend, I think, to talk about purpose in the singular. Like there's one thing that we're supposed to do. And at least in my life, I've found that I've had purposes, plural. That when I was young, I felt it was basketball. And then I got into adulthood and I felt it was to be in law enforcement. And now, in all honesty, as I'm probably coming towards the end of my life, I think my purpose has switched again to put as much goodness, positivity, motivation, love back into the world as I possibly can with whatever time I have left.
Well, that sounds really impressive and clear, and I understand it because I've looked into your background a little, but to somebody listening, that's kind of like what a lot of motivational people say because it's generalizations, but actually what you do is far more useful than those generalizations because you help people change their lives, as I understand it.
I like to think so. You know, again, as you and I were talking before we hit the record button, you know, what is your purpose? It's, I don't have all the answers. You know, I'm not somebody that can sit here and say, well, if you do A, B, and C, you will be successful, you'll be rich, you'll be important. I don't know if that's the case. But what I've done, I think, is learned things, certainly over my life, but also for over these last 12 years of dealing with cancer, of having my foot amputated, having my leg amputated during COVID and things like that, that I just offer to people and say, hey, consider this. Maybe this will work in your life. Maybe it won't, but consider that. And without sounding conceited, I think I'm able to walk the walk as much as I talk the talk. And I certainly talk the talk a lot, don't get me wrong. But I really, I can back up what I say with what I've been through.
Yes, which gives you authenticity, and also it comes across with a sense of humility, which is, you know, expressed as, well, look, I don't have all the answers, but take some of this. If it's useful, use it.
Yeah.
But the most powerful thing, I think, in my experience, listening to you and seeing you in other formats when I've watched videos and so forth and listened to podcasts, is that you are a role model. And that's what I think chimes very well with Get a Better Handle on Life, because what I think with this podcast is, ever since I was a little kid, I've always been a bit of a loner, and I've wanted to, or I've always felt outside. I never thought people liked me, for example. I still have trouble with it, and I'm in my 70s. You know, I kind of think it's a privilege that people attach themselves to me. I've never had any sort of the sort of self-belief that carries me through the need to sort of feel that I'm on top of everything. I certainly have never felt that. And it's always a learning process. But I think that the thing I have always had is this idea that, and this is thanks to my mother in particular, you know, bad stuff doesn't have to become part of your identity. Right. That bad stuff happens to you. It isn't you. And I've got this switch in my head. Something happened to me last week, which is on the podcast elsewhere, so I'm not going to go into it. But it could have been, at somebody at my age, it could have been very frightening. But actually, I was curious about it. And what happened was that my mind, I observed it happening. Within half an hour or so, I'm thinking, half an hour of what once the medics got hold of me and I knew what was happening, I'm thinking, what can I get out of this? You know, when I was younger, it would be, how can I turn this into a job, say? But these days, it's, what can I learn? What can I demonstrate by how I conduct myself now? What can I demonstrate to other people? Now, that may sound a little immodest, but it's automatic. And I feel really strongly that if one can do this stuff, have control of the mind and control it, and control maybe is the wrong word, isn't it? But it becomes a reflex.
Yeah. It does. And you make a great point. You know, I think we should all be lifelong learners. And I had this preconceived notion that the more I read, the more I studied, the more of my questions would be answered. And I'd start to sort of fill myself up with knowledge and things like that. And Barry, what I found is it's just the opposite. The more I learn, the more I understand, the more questions I have, you know, and it's, so there's this inverse relationship with having knowledge. You want more knowledge because you have more questions. And I think so many people sort of get to a point in their life and they're like, all right, I know enough. You know, I don't need to learn more. I don't need to understand anything. I'm good. I've got enough. Until they butt up against something where like, I have no idea what's going on here. I need to learn more. So if you are constantly a lifelong learner, if you're constantly interested in people, in organizations. One of the things that when I was a hostage negotiator, we were taught was to always use our curious voice, to always be, well, what happened there? Tell me more about that. And sort of delve into that, because that develops trust with people. And when you develop trust, then you're able to modify behavior. And that, so it was just, I've always been a curious person, you know, the how, what, when, where, why questions. I ask those all the time of people. And you know, people are so narcissistic that they love talking about themselves. I'll give you a quick story. My wife and I used to go to her like holiday parties and things like that at her office. And I would tell her, okay, before we go in, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to find five people and I'm going to go in there and I'm going to ask them all about themselves. And at the end of the night, when we're driving home, I'm going to tell you about, you know, Bob and Fred and Mary and Tom and Sally. And I said, not only that, but Monday morning when you go to work, they're going to come into your office and they're going to tell you what a great guy I am, but they're not going to know anything at all about me because people never reciprocate. I always tell our daughter, you want to be a great conversationalist? Just ask people questions. Ask them about themselves. You don't have to say a word. Just let them talk. So, I mean, my wife, you used to drive my wife nuts because we would come back from the party and I'm like, okay, here's all about these people that she never knew. And sure enough, Monday morning, they would, oh, your husband's a great guy. Really? What do you know about my husband? Nothing.
Yeah. you just made me think of something. I mean, first of all, that's a great anecdote. Secondly, it chimes exactly with what I used to teach, conflict resolution. One of the things I was always saying is that the part of communication people never think about is the silences and the questions. These are very powerful tools, and they're all you need, really. Right. Pay attention, be curious, listen, and be comfortable with silence. And they were very useful things that I developed a habit of making. I still have to say I talk too much, as you probably noticed already.
But I feel the same way, yes. I don't think you talk too much.
But then I think, you know, well, anyway, that's about me. But the point being that you've just made me think of something else as well, which is, well, I just want to mark a point. You see how every conversation, I know I don't need to tell you this, that every conversation is a learning experience because we're firing off each other and we're throwing out ideas and we're both getting ideas we wouldn't have had in any other setting. So I say this to people all the time. They say, oh, I don't want to go to therapy. I know what my problems are. I say, listen, when you get into conversation with somebody, something happens that neither of us can do individually. I call it the third mind. You know, something happens between us and we both become smarter. We both get insight into things we didn't see before this or couldn't have seen before this. And so that's the value of it. And, of course, that goes on, that process, when we stop talking. Because I'll be carrying your ideas and your words with me, I know, for a long time, you know, because already you've said things which have really set my mind buzzing. So I've probably lost my track altogether now. But what I want to get to is one of your recordings I saw, one of the videos, you said something about the healthy aspect of being sick. And that caught my attention. Can you tell us about that? You're listening to Get a Better Handle on Life with me, Barry Winbolt. I'm speaking to Terry Tucker, motivational speaker and cancer survivor, about his sense of purpose, his level of motivation, and how on earth he keeps so upbeat in the face of what has been a very difficult 12 years. So, Terry, I was asking you about your comment about the healthy aspects of being sick.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen so many people that have just turned their life over to somebody with a white coat with initials after their name when they find out they have some kind of a diagnosis. Most of the people that I interact with at the hospital are cancer patients. It's just the area where I'm at. And I've always wanted my life to be based on the decisions that I made, not on the ones that somebody else made or the ones that I didn't make. And so, you know, I want to focus on the positive things, what I learn. I'm a very curious person, as I said, so I'm always asking my doctors questions. I'm always reading up on things and saying, hey, you know, what about this? I'm in a university setting for my treatment for my cancer, and so I have access to different people, like an oncology pharmacist. So when I see something, for example, there were two doctors in Portugal who were doing an experiment with DHA, which is a fatty fish oil that's supposed to be good for your heart. And they found that during their research that the DHA acted as a sort of Trojan horse for cancer cells. They picked it up and it killed them. So I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. It's DHA. It's over the counter. It's not a prescription medication. So I went to my pharmacist and I said, hey, I want to take this. Is this okay? And she went, well, let me research it, and came back. And she said, we don't want you to take it. And then gave me a reason that I could understand. I had a blood clot. I'm on a blood thinner. She said, DHA also thins your blood. We don't want to thin your blood too much because you might bleed out. All right, that makes sense to me. But I want to be involved in my healthcare. I want to be involved in this. I want to learn from it. And I also want to be able to take what I learn and offer it to other people. So I guess that's kind of what I meant when I made that statement.
Okay. Well, I remember in my training 30 or so years ago, I went to a place called the Bristol Cancer Help Center, which was revolutionary at the time. I'm talking about the early 90s. And I sat in on some of the sessions there. And the people who seemed to be doing best had not done, as you say, handed over themselves to the white coats. They were actually... one person actually said to me, yeah, I have cancer, but that's just a part of me. It's not me. And that's why I think your phrase, the healthy aspects of being sick, you know, use what's working in you. You know, maybe something isn't working too well. And I found through my life that I've had various things happen. And the ability to keep a handle on, even if it's not possible for me today, even if today I'm feeling really cut up about some bad news or something like that, I knew there was a place where I didn't feel like that and I could get back there. I've always known that. And one of the metaphors I used with somebody recently was very depressed. She said to me something about feeling lost, and I thought, well, this idea came to me. I said, you know, and I knew she had worked at the marina, so she knew a little bit about boats. I said, can you row? She said, yeah. I said, well, have you ever been in one of those situations where you're rowing against the current and you can't reach the shore? And you know that if you don't row directly, if you try going diagonally or you sit it out, you just hold your position, eventually the tide will turn, the current will change, the wind will change, something, but you'll get back to the shore. You can see the shore, but you can't get there. And she knew exactly what I was talking about. And I said, well, do you think you can see the shore now in your life? And she said, well, yeah, I spoke grudgingly, because often people, when they're in the depths of despair, they don't want to see the bright picture. It's almost like, you're not taking this away from me. You know, this bad stuff is the one thing I've got. And if you take this away from me, I'm kind of admitting how stupid I was before, or something. I don't know what it is. Have you noticed that in people?
I have. And you know, it's sort of a piling on kind of effect. You know, the more lousy you feel, the more lousy you want to feel. And so you just keep piling that on until you get to a point where I don't know how to feel good anymore. And I always try to tell people, you know, no matter how stinky, slimy, smoky your life gets, it can never, no matter how bad that darkness is, it can never, ever, ever overcome the light in your soul. It's there. You just have to keep going. And you're right. I spent 5 years on a drug called interferon when I was diagnosed with cancer. I was basically told that I'd be dead in 2 years, 12 years ago. And, you know, kind of like you say, doctors are like, you know, like gamblers. They play the odds. Okay, for your age, for your disease, and your stage of your disease, you've got X number of years or X number of months left. What doctors don't know is that you want to see your kid graduate from high school, or you want to walk your daughter down the aisle, or you want to see your grandkids born. That is an incredibly powerful tool to keep your mind engaged and keep your body going. And what I found now is that, you know, we're making such advances in cancer, that cancer is rapidly becoming a chronic disease as opposed to a terminal disease. But absolutely, you know, people feel lousy. And the more lousy you feel, the more you want to feel lousy. And the better you feel, the better you want to feel. So understand that we're all going to have bad days. But let me go back to the interferon. So 5 years of interferon. I took a weekly injection that gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week. And Barry, there was a point where I kind of felt there was two camps. There was the living and there was the not dying. And I felt I was in the not dying category. It really, didn't really feel I was living. I just felt I was not dying. If you would ask me my goals, I would have said, I just need to wake up tomorrow morning. That was as far out in the future as I could possibly go. And I remember literally praying to die. I'm like, come on, God, this is not living. This is just not dying. But I learned so much during that. I learned how much more pain I could endure. I learned how to callous my mind, to get my mind right. It's like, yes, this sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace the suck and make the very best I can out of this day.
You've also said that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. So was there a point at which you kind of had an aha moment, an epiphany, and you realized that, or did you gradually come to that understanding?
I remember, so I was on interferon for 5 years and eventually ended up in the intensive care unit with a body temperature of 108 degrees, which is usually not compatible with being alive due to the toxicity of the interferon. And I remember laying on the gurney in the emergency room, and literally I had tears rolling down my cheeks, and my wife was right next to me, and I begged her to let me die. I'm like, I am so sick of being sick. I just want out of this. And it's amazing how you think about different things when you're in that moment. But there was a story, I remember a story about a professor at Johns Hopkins University here in the United States back in the 1950s. And this is going to sound weird, like I'm literally 108 degrees, I'm dying, and I'm remembering this story about rats. And this professor took rats and he put them in a tank of water that was over their head. And he wanted to see how long the average rat would tread water. And the average rat treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as those rats were getting ready to sink and drown, he reached in, grabbed them, pulled them out, dried them off, and let them rest for a while. And then he took the exact same rats and put them back in that exact same tank of water. And the second time around, on average, those rats treaded water for 60 hours. And wow. I thought, amazing, 15 minutes. It's not like you're going to flunk a test or your business is going to go under. You're going to die. Your life is going to be over. And the second time around, 60 minutes, which taught me two things. The importance of hope in our lives, that if we know we're doing the right thing, maybe not today, maybe not this month, maybe not even this year, but at some point in time, more than likely, we're going to get to where we want to be. And the second thing it taught me was just how much more our physical bodies can handle than we ever thought they could. We quit. We give up. We give in long before our bodies are ready to do, because our brain tells us, this hurts. This is uncomfortable. I don't like this. Stop this. Everybody has a breaking point, don't get me wrong, but I think that breaking point is so much further down the road, and we quit because our brains tell us to.
Yeah, and I'm, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the environment as well, the environment we're in, you know, the pessimism that when you have, I have had an experience in my life, I wasn't terminally ill, fortunately, but my somebody I loved very much was, and they eventually passed on. And she, the moment, the day she had her diagnosis, she put a red line through 50% of the address book. She said, I'm not seeing these people anymore. They won't be able to do. I mean, how she had this intuition, I don't know. They won't be able to cope with this. And she was spot on. And the people that were privileged enough, and it was a very small number in the end, to kind of be in regular contact, they treated her like a living organism, a living human being who was sick, not somebody who was dying. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard for them as well, but they stuck to that. And I thought that was a tremendous learning point, because it's really hard when you are ill or you have some terrible loss in your life. It's really hard breaking the news to other people, because if you're a person with any sort of empathy, you worry about them and how they're going to take it. Do you find that has happened to you?
I do. I am on a clinical trial drug now for the tumors that I have in my lungs. And the people that I started on this drug with have all passed away, unfortunately. But there was one individual, and I mean, a really nice woman, a professional woman, but she was so negative. And she would almost suck the life out of you, you know, hanging around her. And the people who I was on this with, we were in the doctor's office at the same time, in the lab getting blood work at the same time, in the infusion center. So we really didn't have much of a choice to be, you know, other than to hang around each other. And I liked her and I wanted to be there for her because she was very scared. But at the same time, I was like, man, you are sucking the life out of me. You are sucking the positivity out of me because of your negativity. And I thought, is it just me? I heard her sister talk to her once, like, you're the most negative person that I know. So yeah, you want to surround yourself with people that build you up, that care about you, that love you, that want the best for you. Not just in when you're going through an illness, but I've always said, and you could probably back this up in your psychology, the five most important people you hang around with are going to be the people that you turn out like. If you hang around with good people, smart people, people with character, you're going to be good, smart, and a person of character. Versus if you hang around people that are always negative, that there's always drama in their life, that nothing's ever good, then that's the way you're going to turn out as well. So I just want to surround myself with people that make me better. You know, it's that old, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you need to find another room, you know, and I love that. But yeah, absolutely. I want people around me that I can help and that can help me, that we feed off each other's positive and motivational energy.
Well, they say, don't they, misery loves company. But I don't know of a saying that goes the other way, that says, like, you know, positivity loves company. But actually, yeah, it's much more important. But I guess that's just another example of how the bad news always hits the headlines and we forget the good stuff. We've talked a lot about cancer. And I'm saying this now for a listener, for the listener. I wouldn't want to give the impression this is... I hope that people can see the bigger picture and not get stuck with a specific type of illness, because actually this is about life and it's about an approach to life. It just so happens that one of your worst trials has been around your illness, but also one of your proving grounds, because it's allowed you to demonstrate vividly who you are as a person, what you stand for, and to test your own beliefs in your mindset and your attitude and all of that, and to keep coming up. And actually, you just said very interestingly, sadly, you're the only person in that group who's still, you know, plugging away out there, and the others have all passed on. Now, I know it's never that simple as how positive somebody is, but time and again, study after study, attitude comes up. And this isn't just about, as I said, about an illness, because, you know, you get these programs on TV, these fly-on-the-wall things about business, and you get these people kind of putting a veneer over who they are by saying, yeah, I give 110%, yeah, I'm always positive, I'm always upbeat, and all of that power talk. But actually, it's probably not what's happening inside, because if it's happening inside, you don't really need to say that, you just live it. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely would, and I don't want anybody listening to our conversation to think that I don't have bad days. I mean, you're looking at me right now. There's no S on my chest. I do not have a cape and fly around with magical powers. I have bad days. You know, I go to the hospital for an entire week, every 3 weeks, and am treated Monday through Friday with this drug that is very much helping me, but also beats the heck out of me in terms of my side effects. So yeah, I need... You know, I need those people to understand that I cry, I get down, I feel sorry for myself. I just don't let myself stay there. And one of the ways I look at this, and this is something I think I learned from team sports. As I mentioned, I started playing basketball when I was 9 years old and played up until I graduated from college when I was 21. And I think one of the things that I learned from that process was the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You know, you realize on a team that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, your parents down, etc. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. And the way I look at this drug therapy is it's a trial drug, so it's not available to the general public yet. It's still in trial. is that it may not save my life, but it may save the life of somebody 5 years from now, 10 years from now, based on the data that the doctors are gleaning from my blood tests and my scans and things like that. And the way I look at that is being part of something that's bigger than yourself.
Yes. Well, the studies show in psychology that it may be a faith, it may be a community, it may be, as you say, a team, or the human race for that matter, but being committed and engaged with something bigger than yourself is always very important. And of course, if you think what depression does, it does the opposite. It makes us self-obsessed. We become the center of the universe. It's our misery. Nobody else understands. It isolates us. And these are very genuine and sincere feelings for the sufferers, and it's horrible. But the fact is, if we can reach out and connect, then we are doing others a favor as well as ourselves. And don't they say that, you know, when you help somebody else, you help yourself. And if you make that a daily habit, in a way, or a state of mind, then presumably we get some payoff. I'm Barry Winbolt, and you're listening to Get a Better Handle on Life. I'm speaking to motivational speaker Terry Tucker.
And I find that. I find that when I'm in those dark places, those ugly places, one of the best ways out of that is to, you know, you find yourself, as you say, you're isolated, you're looking inside, everything is about you. And I find an easy way, not that it's easy, but an easier way is to find somebody else and just connect with them. You know, I like I said, I'm at the hospital every 3 weeks, so I can find a lot of people that are having a bad day. Hey, how's it going? How you doing? What's going on? You want to have a cup of coffee? You want to talk? Now, all of a sudden, I'm not focused on me anymore and how bad I'm feeling. I'm focused on another human being and making their life better. And all of a sudden, I start feeling better. So, yeah, you're right. That connection is incredibly important.
How about, you know, you mentioned your wife earlier. How is, and I know from experience how hard it is being a carer in a situation like that. Is she of a similar mindset to you, or has she kind of soaked it up from you? Or how is she dealing with it, and how do you support her?
Yeah, she is 10 times stronger than I am, 10 times tougher than I am. She's of Norwegian descent, so we always kind of, you know, it's like you're a stoic Norwegian in that. But I would be dead several times over if it had not been for her seeing something or noticing something and not being afraid, not saying, hey, that's not right. Let's go get this checked out. Let's not wait until we see the doctor in 2 or 3 days. Let's do this now. So incredibly important. But I'll give you a kind of a funny story. And this is an absolute true story. It happened this way. So when I had my leg amputated and I found out I had these tumors in my lungs, my oncologist wanted to put me on chemotherapy. And I was 8 years into this fight. And I said to him, is it going to save my life? And he said, well, probably not, but it might buy you some more time. And I said, well, if the outcome is going to be the same, I'm not sure I want to go through all that ugliness. I'd rather take whatever time I have. But I said, I'll go home and talk to my family. So it's just my wife and daughter and I. And so I go home and I start telling them what's going on. And my daughter is immediately, all right, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting? There's three of us. It's not like we got a board here or something like that, you know? So we sit around the kitchen table and individually talk about how we feel about me having chemotherapy. And then when we're done with that, my daughter's like, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raised their hand. I'm like, wait a minute. Am I getting outvoted for something I don't want to do? But I remembered when I was back in the police academy, our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we love the most to class. And as we were learning different techniques to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself. So I ended up taking chemotherapy, not because I wanted to, but because I love my wife and daughter more than I love myself. And in hindsight, it was the right thing to do. It was the bridge that got me to the drug that I'm on now. But if it hadn't been for the two of them fighting me on, I don't want to take chemotherapy, I'm done with this, you and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right. I like the idea of you being outvoted. about something that concerns you so profoundly. And I was, yes, you mentioned being in the basketball team from 9 to 21. And I was thinking earlier, well, the athletic kind of mindset was instilled very early. And you were obviously good. You were somewhere up in your league among your peers. Otherwise, you wouldn't have got into college on the basis of that. Because I think you got a college because you got a scholarship, didn't you?
Right.
Because of your basketball, because of your sport. So I guess that early training, time and again, is very important. I grew up in the country, in this country, in the UK. We had no gas, no electricity. In those days, the houses didn't. Ours didn't. But we were, we're a comfortable, well-to-do, middle-class family. Well, except we had no money, but that had all gone. And I remember, I don't know if it's apocryphal or if it's true, but my mother's favourite phrase, "It won't kill you, dear." And we were always coming home with accidents. We fell out of trees. We dropped things on ourselves. We, fell off a horse or, in my case, a donkey. So it was her matter-of-fact attitude to injury that really instilled in me her calm demeanour. And I often think about our parents at that time because, they'd just been through the Second World War.
Right.
I was born the year after the war ended, so they'd just been through all of that. And they were losing friends left, right and centre. They never spoke about it, but that must have instilled some sort of grit. And some of us were lucky enough. I have two sisters, same story. We often joke about it, but we weren't allowed to be ill, really. It wasn't a cruel thing at all. I came home one day blinded. We'd been playing in the park with some friends at night, and there were bushes, and we were flinging clods of earth at each other through the bushes to see if we could hit. And somebody hit me straight in the eyes. And it was pitch dark in the park, so I didn't think much of it. It hurt. They took me out to the road, and I couldn't see the lights. And we lived about a quarter of a mile from where this happened. So my friends took me home, rang the doorbell. My mother opened the door and said, "Here he is." They left pretty quickly. And she said, "Oh, you're probably just in shock, dear. Just go to bed. We'll take a look in the morning." I mean, obviously, she examined me. And sure enough, my eyesight came back. No lasting damage. And she had some nursing training in the war and that sort of thing. But, it's that unflappability that has to be a really great resource. And if you're one of those people with that, that serves people around you very, very well. Because I think if they don't see us panic, then there's less, less disruption to them.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, my parents, my dad was in the army right after World War II, but lived through it as a kid and the rationing and all kinds of things like that. And it made them tougher. It made them stronger. It made them more resilient. And I think, and I'm going to make a huge generalization now, but I think that's sort of the problem in the world today. The people are soft because everything is easy. I mean, you have access to all the knowledge in the world based on these screens in front of us. You can look up anything and find stuff and learn from it, but it's almost like it's too easy. I don't have to work for it, so I don't really care. This sort of laissez-faire attitude of, well, it doesn't really matter, I'll figure it out later and stuff like that. I think it was Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor during World War II, who made the comment, everybody has a purpose in life. There's no abstract meaning of your life. You have a moral responsibility to find out the reason you were put on the face of this earth and live that reason. And I just don't see people do that. I remember I was having a conversation with a young man who just graduated from college, and he was a football player, not a soccer player, but an American football player. And he was talking to me about, he was interviewing for a sales job. And he said, what do you think the person's going to ask me? And I said, well, let's back up for a second. I said, if you could only do one job in your life, one thing that you absolutely loved, what would that be? And he said, I'd be a football coach. I said, then why are we talking about a sales job? Well, I got to make money. I said, no, you can make money being a football coach. I said, every human resources survey I've ever seen in my life ranked compensation 8th or 9th on the list. There are much more important things than money. I get it. You're just out of college. You want to make your mark on the world. But can you make your mark better educating, teaching people to play football? Or can you do that by chasing the almighty dollar? And Barry, he didn't like what I had to say, and I haven't heard from him since. But I'm like, okay, that's fine. I can't make you change. I can only offer you advice and say, this would make you happy. This would make you fulfilled. This is what you're telling me is in your heart. And whenever I speak to young people, I always try to tell them this. If there is something in your heart, something in your soul that you believe you're supposed to do, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Because at the end of your life, the things you're going to regret are not going to be the things you did. They're going to be those things you didn't do. And by then, it's going to be too late to go back and do them.
Absolutely. And I've said to my kids, you know, do what you love. Don't do what I did, which is go for the money. And I wasted half my life, probably more. I didn't waste it. But, you know, I was doing the wrong things until I was 40, probably. And then I started, interestingly, and I mention this because that's part of what this podcast is about, dishing out stuff that I hope people will listen to and find engaging and possibly useful, is the idea that about 10 years ago, really for sure, perhaps a bit before, I started doing things for no money. Not because I could afford it, but because I was interested and I was at a point in my life where I didn't know what else to do. So I just started to think about, I wonder if you can make a living by thinking. So I Googled it because I like doing that. I thought, what else do I like doing? I thought, I like walking around the countryside where we live. We live in a very beautiful place. I like walking the dog, particularly, and I like drinking beer. So I made a business that involved those things with my wife. We made a business. I met a Canadian guy, Adrian Jurek, who does a similar thing in Canada. And we made a job. We made a business, two separate businesses, where we would take groups of people out into nature. We'd get to a nice hotel. We'd spend a couple of hours with them, giving them some tools. And then we'd say, now go out and do this until lunchtime. Walk down the river, talk to anybody else you like, but do this. And one task might be, say, about observation. Notice this or whatever. And then they'd come back and they'd never done any of the stuff we asked them, but they'd had a great time. And I'd proved the point that actually when you put people together, they do the work. If you give them the environment and the tools, they do the work. And that's exactly what happened. But the point being that from that point on, I have taken the odd job for money, but mostly I've said to people, yeah, I'll do that for you. And in one case, it was during lockdown, there's a lot of stuff going on. I have earned as much money from that day to this, from I don't know how, from doing things for nothing for people, and somehow it turned, but things I loved, and somehow it turned into income. And I mean, I've had to do other work as a result, but that's absolutely my lesson for life, you know, that do what you love. I'd heard it, but I didn't see how I could do it. I didn't dare. And the moment I did it, here I am talking to you. And I could talk for so long to you. I'm sorry. I feel I've stolen some of your time by giving my own
No. This has been, love this. This is great.
So, you know, one question always, I do a show on radio too about business, local business people around here. And one of the things that I always am trying to get, you mentioned bridge earlier, but in a different context, you said that the chemo was a bridge into the research program that you're on, which turned out to be a great opportunity for you. Right. And when somebody is, as I call it, in the doldrums, you know, they're lost, they're maybe not feeling too good about themselves or whatever, they're listening to this because they want the signpost in life, they want the thing that's going to point them in the right direction. And I can tell you now, if you listen to this, you won't find it here, okay? But, you know, the penny might drop later. And so what does one say? How do you bottle what you've got and say, well, yeah, it's fine to think positively, but I don't know how. And one thing I'd just like to say about thinking positively, you know, there's positive thinking, which I eschew completely, and there's thinking positively. So would you agree with that? But thinking positively is about how you think. Positive thinking is like, take this lesson and just do this, and it probably won't work.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the research group that I was reading an article on that was saying that 80% of our thoughts are negative, and that's more of a defense mechanism to keep us alive. You know, I mean, if you got up this morning, Barry, and said, "Hey, I'm going to go skydiving," your brain would immediately start. Oh, wait a minute, Barry. Hey, the plane might crash. Your parachute may not open. You know, it would start listing all the things that might happen that were negative. It wouldn't say, hey, Barry, great experience. Yeah, go check it out. It would always default to the negative. And you have to be able to overcome that. And I think one of the easiest ways, but somehow the most difficult way, and I always recommend this to people. I do this, I recommend it because I do it myself every day. Every day, do one thing that scares you, that makes you nervous, that makes you uncomfortable, that's potentially embarrassing. It doesn't have to be a big thing. But if you do those small things every day, when that negativity comes into your life, you know, well, like, what are you talking about there? Get up in the morning and make your bed. You know, you're watching Netflix on television. Oh, I should go to the gym. I don't want to go to the gym. Go to the gym. You know, I need to study for this test, but I want to hang out with my friends. Study for the test. Do the ugly things, the difficult things, the hard thing that you don't want to do, because that will callous your brain. That will make you stronger, more resilient, tougher individual. And so it's not a hard thing to do. It's just an uncomfortable thing to do.
Yeah.
And people don't like the uncomfortable.
Well, and actually, as I'm listening to you, I'm realizing that that is how my mind works. But from very early on, I think it was probably again from my upbringing, you do what you have to do, not necessarily what you want to do. So you do right by the other person was, you know, it's a value thing, and it's a pain in the neck sometimes because you want to do the nice thing for yourself, not the hard thing for somebody else. And there are parables about that and all of that. But the thing that occurs to me is that, you know, it doesn't have to be a big thing. It can be a small thing that you don't want to do. Like, I have a book here that I promised a colleague of mine I would review, and it's been sitting here for 3 months, to my certain knowledge. And why is it here? So I won't forget it. But I look at it and I can't do it. I don't know why. Now I know I have to. I'll do it tomorrow morning. In fact, I'll do it right after this. How's that for a commitment? And thank you for that. Thank you. So one lesson people can take away, one message people can take away from this is do the rubbish things that you don't really want to do, or do something that actually you have a slight aversion for, or even a big aversion. But actually, of course, what that requires is to have the self-awareness of your own thoughts, to rather than just, I don't want to do it, you've got to be able to mind that feeling a bit and understand that there's something going on with you, which is a decision-making process, which is keeping you away from doing that thing to keep you comfortable. But you've got to walk through the discomfort a bit. Start with the small stuff, but do something every day. That's really good advice. And, that is really good advice, because do something that tests your ability to step outside the comfort, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I learned this when I was like 15 years old. I had 3 knee surgeries because of basketball injuries when I was in high school. And I remember when I went back playing basketball, my brain was putting all kinds of negative thoughts into my mind. You know, things like, hey, you're probably a step slower since your surgeries, and college coaches aren't going to be interested in recruiting you. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, I am still playing at an elite level, and coaches are still reaching out about the possibility of playing for their college or university. I learned I needed to change the narrative. I needed to put something positive into that. But you're right. It's the awareness of, oh, wait a minute, that's a negative thought. That's not something I like. That's not something. And you know, that old saying of, we all become what we think. So if you think you're bad and, you know, you're lousy and you're not good at this, you think about that long enough, eventually your brain is going to hardwire itself to the point where, yeah, you're right. You are lousy. You're never going to be good at this. So be very careful. And we all talk to ourselves, whether we like to admit it or not. Be very careful with that self-talk. Make that self-talk positive experiences for your brain, because your brain doesn't understand the context of a lot of what you say. It just knows whether it's good or bad. It's good or bad. It's something I should do or something I shouldn't do. It's positive, it's negative. Put that in context. Be positive as much as you can with the understanding you are going to have negative thoughts. The most positive person in the world is not somebody who doesn't have a negative thought. They do. But they just find a way through that negative thought into something positive.
Can you give an example of when you had to do that recently? Something that was even new for you, it tested you.
So I had somebody reach out to me and said, you should do cold therapy. You know, there's this thing where, you know, you plunge into water. And that's kind of difficult for me being in a wheelchair. So I'm like, all right, how can I do this? And I didn't want to do it. I hate cold. I absolutely hate cold. But every night when I take a shower, I now, right before, you know, I take a nice hot shower, I'm feeling good, and then I take that handle and I turn it all the way to cold, and I just wait. And it's like, oh, I hate that. That it feels uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable. I don't like it. And I give myself a count. You know, I'm working my way up to 5 minutes, and it's, you know, I just count and I just immerse myself in that cold water. I hate doing that.
But wow.
That's five minutes. That's an example.
Well, we live 300 meters from the sea. And during lockdown, my wife and I swam right through the winter. And when I say swim, it would be maybe 30 seconds, maybe 2 minutes. I mean, she's tougher than me. And then I read that the research said it's the shock that's important. It's how the water shocks your body. Now, I was already doing cold showers because I heard a mountain climber who'd lost the use of his legs some years ago. I heard him on the radio, and the guy said, the interviewer said, well, you know, how come? How do you get the motivation to get yourself up in the day and to, you know, your life was... Because he's still climbing mountains, to my shame, I can't remember his name. But the climber said, take a cold shower every day. And the interviewer was kind of waiting for more, I think. And he said, well, I have no legs. So when I turn that cold water on, there's nowhere to go. And he said, after that, you could face anything.
Right.
Now, I started taking cold showers, and I only do cold showers now, unless I'm at the gym and the cold showers don't work, because they often don't. But I miss them if I don't, and I get an endorphin rush.
Yeah.
But my limit is about, well, not it's not so much a limit. I only subject myself to that till I get that rush, which is about 30 seconds,
okay.
Maybe a minute. I won't say I like it, but that I attribute a lot to that, and it gets me going in the morning. And so I'm a bit of an evangelist about that. So and I've seen in people their depression lift, like all the time they're doing cold water swimming. So I'm a big exponent of that. So Terry, it's been a real joy talking to you, sincerely, and I'm buoyed up for the rest of the day and probably the rest of the week.
Good.
Would you like to tell us a moment about your book? You've got one book out and another one on the way, is that right?
Yeah, one's out and I'm working on about 180 pages into a second one right now, first draft, so it's going to be a little while, but the book is called Sustainable Excellence, the 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. And it was really a book that was born out of two conversations that I had. One was with a former player that I had coached in high school who had moved to the area in the United States where my wife and I live with her fiance. And the four of us had dinner one night. And I remember saying to her after dinner that I was excited that she was living close and I could watch her find and live her purpose. And Barry, she got real quiet and she looked at me and she's like, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? I said, I have absolutely no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about. Finding the reason you were put on the face of this earth, using your unique gifts and talents and living that reason. And then the other story was a young man who reached out to me on social media and asked me what I thought were the most important things he should learn to not just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And I didn't want to give him that, you know, get up early, work hard, help others. And not that those aren't important. Those are. But I wanted to see if I could go deeper and eventually came up with these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I stepped back and I was like, well, I got a life story that fits underneath that principle. Or I know somebody whose life emulates this principle. So literally during the months I was healing after I had my leg amputated, I sat down at the computer every day and I built stories, and they're real stories about real people underneath each of the principles, and that's how Sustainable Excellence came to be.
Great. What a great story, and a great book, I'm sure. I'll have a look at it.
Thank you.
I only regret I didn't have more time before we spoke. Thank you very much for your time, Terry Tucker, today. It's been a real pleasure, and, you know, let's keep in touch, because these conversations, I mean, you know, it's just... Well, it's utterly selfish on my part because I get to talk to people like you, but, well, you're unique, so how can I say that? But you know what I mean.
Thank you.
I just love having these conversations. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, Barry, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. That's it from me. My sincere thanks to Terry Tucker for his time and his energy. If you've enjoyed this or found it useful, please subscribe, leave a comment, or share it on social media, or even all three. This is me, Barry Wimbolt. Until next time, all the best.